Good evening. It's good to see everyone here tonight. It's good that we can come together to worship our God. How many preachers does it take to preach at Broadmoor? In all seriousness, though, just want to extend a word of appreciation to Conrad for his work and his effort. Just appreciate so much his conviction and what he had to say today and in his class. Appreciate not only his words, but him as a person. And so I want to urge him to continue on. We all have room for improvement, and you do as well, but continue on. And so appreciate that very much. And I think I believe I speak on behalf of Broadmoor. We all love and appreciate you. Also appreciate the songs that were led by Gilbert as we thought about one of the most dramatic scenes in all of Scripture. In fact, tonight I'd just like to simply open up our Bibles to Matthew chapter 26 and look at the prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. Matthew 26 in the Garden of Gethsemane. And what I'd like to do is consider what takes place in the garden from the perspective of the participants. So first of all, let's consider Jesus in the garden. Imagine, if you would for a moment, if you were Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. After supper with the disciples, in which you ate with your betrayer, we see that Jesus sings a hymn, as was the custom, and he goes out to the Mount of Olives. And as he goes out to the Mount of Olives, the Garden of Gethsemane, which I believe was in there with the Mount of Olives. As he goes out there, he takes three of his closest disciples. The enormity of the moment seems to take hold right here and now as Jesus considers the fact that he's about to die. Now you remember that this is nothing new for Jesus. In Matthew chapter 16, we see that he asks, "Who do people say that I am?" And there Peter proclaims, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And that had something in Peter's mind about what it meant to be the Christ, the Messiah. Jesus affirms, "Yes, that's true. I am the Christ. I am the Messiah." But directly after that, he says, "And as the Messiah, I'm going to die." He repeats that statement a few chapters later. I am going to die. This was nothing new to Jesus. But what is new is the display of emotion. Jesus seems to simply state it matter-of-factly. Matthew doesn't record anything about his emotions. It's simply not there in the text. But notice in Matthew 26, in verse 36, Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to the disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." What would you do if you were Jesus facing such an important decision? It's hard for me to bring this into a modern context, to bring this into something that we can relate with. Jesus had been preparing for this for eternity, all of his life, in a concentrated way through the 3 or so years of his ministry. He had been looking forward to this time. It may seem trite. The best I could come up with would be, a school situation, where you have 3 or 4 years of preparation. And the higher up you go, the more intense it is that you would accomplish your goal. But really, that doesn't even begin to touch what's taking place here, does it? This is a matter of life and death. You'd almost have to add a twist in there. This would be a college situation where you're trying to take the big test to get your degree. And oh yeah, if you don't pass the test, you will be executed. Okay, so a little melodramatic, but a life and death situation. So that's why it's hard to bring into our thinking, because taking a test, well, if you don't pass a test, you try something else. You try something different. It's hard for us to see the enormity of the situation and for us to think about what we would do. But Jesus here becomes troubled and sorrowful. And he asks his disciples to be there with him while he goes and prays. Now, these were the same three disciples that were with him at the Transfiguration. And there you almost get the picture, the idea, that this is so that they can witness what is taking place. So that they can be reminded that Jesus is the Son of God. That they are to hear him and take his message out. That they are to see him elevated as the Son of God. But here you don't get that sense at all, that this is just for them to witness. Jesus seems to need their companionship. He seems to need to lean on them at this time. He seems to need their help, so to speak. He says, "Be here with me for a while." Imagine if you were Jesus in your darkest hour and you turned to your friend. He says, "Stay here and watch with me." Verse 39, and going a little further, he fell on his face praying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." In your darkest hour, would you turn to God? Would you turn to God in fervent prayer, recognizing that he is the one that you need to go to? Would you trust him enough to pray? Jesus did. Jesus' life, all throughout his life, he continually showed the fact that he trusted his Father. He was to be about his Father's business, even at the age of 12. And as he continues on and on and on, he shows full trust in God. But it is at this time that God the Father has the ability to take or to remove from him what he most dreads. He says, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Let the suffering and what is about to happen, let this pass from me." He's asking, is there a plan B here? Is there another way to accomplish your will and your goal without me having to go through this? It's a question that we all need to ask ourselves as we think about our trying circumstances. Would we pray to God as Jesus did? Notice, though, that there are many things that come into this prayer. This is really echoes of the Lord's Prayer. Remember the disciples in Matthew chapter 6, Luke 6, they said, "Teach us how to pray." And Jesus said, as he began to teach them and show them, he says, "Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And here we see echoes of that same prayer as he addresses not just our Father, but my Father. He falls down upon his face, as we sung in the song just now, "Abba, Father." He prostrates himself and cries to his Father. He goes on to say, "Not my will, but your will." As he prayed for the disciples in Matthew 6, "Let your will be done." Here he shows to even greater degree how it is to pray and how they should pray. Because I assume actually that they probably could hear him, that they were probably within earshot. Uses the language that he goes a little further. I don't know that, but that is my guess. But he says, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." Verse 40 says, "And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping." What would you do in your darkest hour, your hour of greatest need, and you called upon your friends, and they failed you? And they failed you. We see that Jesus prays a second time in verse 42. He said, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." I don't know if this is simply a shortened version of the first prayer or actually a different prayer. Notice that there's no request the second time. He doesn't make a request upon God. Maybe he's beginning to realize that this is the only way. And again he says, "Your will be done." If you were Jesus in the garden, would you have the trust that he did? Would you give your faith to the very one that is the Father? Your will be done. That's easy to say, isn't it? We want God's will to be done. But it becomes increasingly more difficult when that will happens to get in the way of our will. When the will of God would mean for us pain and suffering. We want God's will to be done maybe up until a certain point or up until a certain degree. But Jesus here says, "Your will be done," even in the suffering and shame of the cross. Your will be done. He has complete trust in the Father. In verse 43 it says, "And he came and found them sleeping again." It's hard to imagine the impact upon Jesus, the disciples that he had handpicked and selected, as the world was caving in on him. As you read through the Gospels, you see an increasing degree of hostility from the religious leaders, from those that were his opponents. And you see him beginning to take more and more time with his disciples to explain to them, to talk to them. He might have a situation of disagreement with those outside, and then he takes his disciples aside and he explains to them, these were his closest companions on earth. These were the disciples. If he could count on anyone, it would be these people, right? And not only the 12, but the 3 that he selected. But it says that he found them sleeping again. He found them sleeping. The loneliness of the moment must have been weighing on him. As he already felt alone and calls for his disciples to wait with him. And notices time and time again that they are sleeping. The passage says that he went and did this again. He prayed a third time and then he finds the disciples sleeping again. Verse 45. Says that he came to the disciples and said, "Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour's at hand and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." The very moment in which he would be betrayed, as he was preparing for this, as he had been waiting for eternity, for a lifetime, for the 3 years of ministry, the time had come. The time was now, the time of his greatest need. And it is at this time that he turned to his disciples and to his Father. His disciples simply failed him. They could not even wait and watch for him during this time. But it was God, the one that he could call upon, that he could state words of trust to him. But you also see that there's periods of conflict here as well. As he is actually requesting his Father to take this from him. Yet, he continues to trust. I think that's really the idea of what happens on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? As he again echoes Psalm 22 and looks back to Psalm 22. But at the end of that Psalm, we see the basic statement, "Yet will I trust you. I feel abandoned and I don't understand this, but I will trust you." And that's what we see in the prayer. The feelings of abandonment. Yet, he continues to trust God. Because, and we know that he trusts God, because he placed his life in the Father's hands. And he says, "Your will be done." What would we have done? If we were Jesus in the garden, who would we have turned to? How would we have felt? Well, Jesus is not the only one in the garden. the disciples are also in the garden. And it may be a little bit easier for us to put ourselves in their shoes, to picture ourselves in their place. Imagine that you are the disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane. And even more specifically, let's just pick out Peter. Imagine that you are Peter. The disciples had given everything to follow after Jesus. Again, they had been with him for 3+ years. Many of them given up their livelihood. Many of them had given up their families. They had given up their aspirations and their dreams. In a sense, they had given their life to follow after the Messiah. They traveled with him. The time for these disciples must have seemed to be more important. As the language of Jesus became elevated, the importance of it seemed to be more and more. As he began to tell them that he was going to die. As he began to gather them in and spend larger chunks of time with them. As he has the Lord's Supper with them and institutes the Lord's Supper. There must have been a sense that something important is going on here. And notice after the Lord's Supper, a place where they had been arguing over who is the greatest, and Jesus shows them who is the greatest by donning a towel and bowing before them and washing their feet. He is the greatest. But notice verse 31 of chapter 26, the discussion that takes place here. Jesus says, "You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I am raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter, as was his custom, speaks up quickly and first. He says, "Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. Peter said to him, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you." All the disciples said the same. They gave a statement of their oath to God. They professed their undying love to him. They were willing to give their very lives for him. They must have been thinking that we've already given so much for you, and we're willing to go the full degree. We're willing to go to the farthest extent. We will even die for you. Jesus says that before this night is over and the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. 3 seems to be the number of the hour. We see that there are 3 disciples, but Peter, as he is picked out here, we see that the prayer that takes place occurs 3 different times. In a sense, there is a test for these disciples. What would they do for their friend, their master, and their Lord? Well, they've professed in verses 31 through 35 that they were willing to die for him. But really, the Garden of Gethsemane shows us a picture. It's really a test for the disciples. The question is, did they pass the test? Would you have passed the test? Where they're willing to die for him, but they probably dismissed the request of them here as something less significant than that. Something not quite as important. Yes, I'm willing to die for you, but yeah, we'll just, you know, if you're going to go pray, we'll sit over here and watch and wait for you. I don't think the disciples realized the enormity of the situation. They did not realize how important it was to their friend. It wasn't as important to them, but it was extremely important to Jesus. How many times do people call upon us in their hour of need? And yet we think, well, this is not that important, or I intend to help them. You know, I've got these other long lists of things to do. And we fail to help those in their hour of need. The disciples fall under this category. As Jesus says, to watch here with me. Remain here and watch. The passage says that they fell asleep. They fell asleep. The first time when Jesus comes back, it says in verse 41, "Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." The disciples were instructed about this test and how this would really exemplify the many other tests that they would face as well. You see, they had already just proclaimed the fact that they would never deny Jesus. The boast came without a question in their mind. They would never fall, never fail. And Jesus warns them that, yes, the Spirit indeed is willing. The Spirit will make great boasts about what it can accomplish and what it will do. "I will never sin. I'll never commit this sin or that sin." But Jesus says that the flesh is weak. The Bible warns us about making such boasts. "I would never commit murder." Only a lowly person would do that. Only someone else, someone unlike me, certainly. "I would never commit adultery." Never. We make many boasts about the things that we will not do. And it's often in those high times, those spiritual highs, those boasts, that we're actually most vulnerable. You know, for a sports team, and we don't have a lot of soccer illustrations, so I thought I'd add one here. There's not a lot of scoring in soccer. But the team that is most vulnerable, when they're most vulnerable, is right after they've scored a goal. They're most vulnerable to get scored on. There's that sense that we've arrived, we've made it, we've done something good. And see, when you're thinking that, you're not watching. You're not being careful. Coaches that have teams that are rated number one in the country, or teams that have the best team out there, their greatest challenge is to not allow that team to think that they're the best, to overlook their opponents, to say that we're the best, no one can touch us, because they stop trying, they stop training, they stop doing what they need to do. Why? Because they've already arrived, they've already made it. And the same thing can happen for Christians. "I would never do this. I would never do that." And we see fellow Christians fall into that same heinous sin. And then we boast even more. "I would never do what he did." And the fact is that we need to be on our guard. Now, we don't want to say, "Well, I'm going to do that." That's not the point. But we need to, with more humility, state what we will do and state that it is our desire. But we need to realize that, yes, it could happen to us. It could happen to us. "The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." If we were the disciples, would we have heeded this warning in our lives? Would we have heeded this warning? These three small tests really exemplify the tests that would come later. We find that they're sleeping again, and Jesus says simply to take your rest later. The hour is at hand. "To rise up with me, my betrayer is at hand." As Judas was marching with the soldiers that were coming to take him away. And if you remember, Peter jumps up. Now he's ready to fulfill what he had said earlier. "I will die with you." And he takes out his sword and chops off someone's ear. Likely aiming to chop off more than that. Peter's ready now. The fact is, he had failed really one of those tests earlier. And as he fell asleep three times, we see later in this same chapter that he indeed does deny Jesus three times. In fact, after all the army comes to take Jesus away, it says in verse 56 that all the disciples left him and fled. Peter's to be commended somewhat. He gets back into the pathway of Jesus. He begins to follow him again. There's no mention of any other disciples save a few. And then we see the disciple that he loved. But Peter is following. And we see in verses 69 through 75, the very statement when he said that I would never do this. He finds himself in a situation where he does it before he even realizes it, it seems. Let's read verses 69 through 75. Now, Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came up to him and said, "You also were with Jesus the Galilean." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you mean." And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him, and she said to the bystanders, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." And again he denied it with an oath, "I do not know the man." After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Certainly you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you." Then he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know the man." And immediately the rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. He did the very thing that he had promised that he would never do. So there are three small tests. Well, maybe I'm taking the mindset of the disciples. These were big tests, maybe, in the garden. As they were asked to stay awake with God, or with Jesus. Then there are the three denials that occur here. And in John chapter 21, Peter is asked three times, "Do you love me?" To which he responds that he does, and he tells him to feed his sheep. Peter would later become a great servant of the church and the Lord. And if tradition is true, he gave his life for Christ. But these were times of learning for Peter. Times of learning. If you were the disciples, what would you have done? Would you have watched and prayed? Would you have saw this as a learning opportunity? Would you have been there for your friend? Or would your spirit have boasted, but your flesh would have been weak? Maybe the disciples were overconfident. I'm sure that they were overconfident, having stated what they did. The fact is that they did fall. We need to be reminded of 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12. "To the one who thinks he stands, take heed lest he falls." And that's certainly what the disciples did. There's one more character that I want to talk about here in the garden. There's one not mentioned maybe directly, but there was another one in the garden. God was in the garden. God heard the prayers of His Son. As hard as it was for Jesus to pray this prayer, Luke says it had sweat drops as blood falling down. As emotionally distraught as Jesus was in this prayer, I believe it was more difficult for the Father to hear. Like a parent spanking a child and claiming that it's going to hurt them more than it will the child. It's difficult for a parent to see a child go through difficulties and troubles, especially if the parent has control to change that. There's no greater heartache than to see and to watch a child in distress. But we see that God allowed this because of His great love for us. For every single one of us in this room. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. God allowed Jesus to die on the cross, to die a shameful death, so that we might have life. This is the God that Jesus turned to. And this is the God that we should turn to and trust Him with all of our being, knowing that He loves us so. This same God saw the failure of Peter and the disciples. This same God realized their imperfections. But judgment did not come on that night. Rather, they would continue to live their lives and learn from their mistakes. And we see that Peter became a devout servant, as did many of the disciples. But God was there, and God saw Jesus being forsaken, His disciples fleeing from Him, and Jesus crying out with a loud voice, let this pass from me. Let this pass from me. We need to realize that this is the God that we serve, the same God that hears the prayers, not only of Jesus, but of all His children in times of distress. And even though we might not have a prayer answered exactly the way that we want, when we want, God is there and cares. God continues to be there. You know, if we were to end the story with the death of Christ, we may feel completely betrayed by this God. But the fact is, the story does not end there. And God raises Him up and exalts Him to the name that is above every name. That is the God that we serve. The God that hears prayers and that accomplishes His will for what is best in His time. This prayer in the garden is really emotionally filled. If there was ever a fervent prayer, it was in this garden. And I think there's many lessons we can learn from it as we think about what we would do. Because the truth is, we will be asked many times over to face the trials of life with the question, who will I turn to in my darkest hour? Will I trust God, or will I get to the business of trying to control things myself, find my own solutions, and rely on my own being? The question for each one of us is, will we serve our God and trust Him with our lives? Is there anyone here tonight that's not living as a Christian, not following after God? You have an opportunity to commit your life to Him. You have an opportunity to repent of your sins, to make the commitment that you're going to change. You have an opportunity to confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. You have an opportunity to be baptized into the blood of Christ so that you can be raised to walk in newness of life. And God Himself will make you a new creature. If there's any subject to the invitation, please come as we stand and sing at this time.
Without Him I could do nothing. Without Him I truly